The Care Matters podcast is brought to you by the ESRC Centre for Care and Circle, the Centre for International Research on Care, Labour and Equalities. In this series, our researchers welcome experts in the field and those giving or receiving care to discuss crucial issues in social care as we collectively attempt to make a positive difference to how care is experienced and provided.
Hello and welcome to Care Matters, the podcast from the Economic and Social Research Council Centre for Care and the University of Sheffield Circle Research Centre. My name is Duncan Fisher and I'm a Research Associate at the Centre for Care. We are delighted to welcome Richard Humphreys as our guest, and in this episode we will discuss Richard's new book, Ending the Social Care Crisis. This is part of our ongoing series looking at new literature on care. In the book, Richard considers the route to meaningful and enduring positive change for adult social care in England and what we can learn from history and other contexts in this regard. Richard Humphreys is a recognised national commentator on social care and health policy. His current roles include Senior Policy Advisor to the Health Foundation and Newton Europe, and visiting professor at the University of Worcester.
He was senior fellow at the King's Fund from 2009 to 2021, covering social care and integrated care.
Between 2021 and this year, he was a member of the Reimagining Care Commission established by the Archbishops of Canterbury and York, and he was specialist advisor to the House of Lords Economic Affairs Committee inquiry into social care from 2017 to 2019. Building on a career in social work over the past 46 years, he has worked in a variety of roles, including as Director of Social Service and Health Authority Chief Executive, England's first joint appointment, and in senior roles in the Department of Health, working with ministers and senior civil servants. Richard's new book, Ending the Social Care Crisis, the subject of this episode, was published in autumn 2022. Welcome to Care Matters, Richard.
Thank you.
So, Richard, could you please introduce the book to our audience and tell us what the book's about?
Sure. And thanks, Duncan, for inviting me to do this. It's a great pleasure to be doing it with you, and I hope that listeners will find this helpful and maybe a bit educational as well. So the book was really born out of a mixture of motivations, really. First of all, I was a bit frustrated that there's lots of stuff written about adult social care, but none of it in one place. There's lots of really good pieces of work, of articles, of research papers, of blogs and so on, about different aspects of the problems in social care, like workforce or the nature of care services, the need for users to be more involved, but nothing really that pulls it all together in one place. So I'd been mulling this over for some time, that the need to do something. Also frustrated that successive governments over 25 years have been trying to sort out social care and have generally failed. But we don't seem to be learning from that, and we just seem to be repeating the same kind of approaches and processes. And a lot of the thinking as well has been very superficial. But above all, the debate about social care has really been all about negatives, about the so-called burden of care, the costs of care, people stuck in hospital, care homes closing, and nothing about the good that social care can do. And it seems to me, the more I've thought about this, that needs to be the starting point, not all the difficult stuff and the problems. So the book really is an attempt to set out, first of all, what is social care? What do we mean by it? What does it consist of? And I've tried to illustrate that through the voices and experience of people that have had social care needs and used services. And how has it evolved over the years? And that throws up some surprising conclusions about the causes of the current problems. What can we learn from other countries about how they have gone about it? But above all, what can we do and how do we need to go about the process of really sorting out social care that avoids the mistakes of the past and really can lead to some enduring change? So that's it in a nutshell, Duncan.
Okay, thank you very much. And I think that kind of your sort of final, your key point there about the question of what can we do, that's certainly something that we can come back to later in the conversation as something for us to kind of emphasise and discuss further. And just to come back on your answer there, you worked in the social care for a long time, you've been thinking about these ideas, but in terms of the actual process of writing the book, and even the opportunity, how did that more practical side of writing the book for you, how did that kind of come about?
So as I say, I've been thinking about it for some time and I've written all sorts of stuff. I've written articles for journals, peer reviewed stuff, lots of stuff I've published when I was with the King's Fund, but never written a book. So for me, this was a personal development challenge as well. And then, of course, COVID came. So lockdown was a great opportunity to kind of to spend the time on it. But actually, the actual trigger that finally kind of caused me to begin the process was the personal experience I had in sorting out care for my late father, which I talk about it in the book, but it illustrated for me both the best and the worst in our current social care system, and particularly the worst aspects and the nature of the struggle to get good care for him was profoundly affecting for me. Actually, he is me a so-called expert, and it felt like I was an expert by inexperience. The good news is that we got there in the end, and my dad had superb person-centered care in the last 4 years of his life, and good social care gave him his life back. So that's the good news. But getting there, that's a different story. So that was the personal process that caused me to write the book.
And I think that's it's a very interesting point about that word navigating the system, because I think one of the many things that your book does well is kind of capture and convey the complexity of the social care system on so many levels, from funding to legalities and the organisation of it. I'm conscious of your answer to my opening question about so much of what we hear about social care focusing on the negatives, and your attempt to think maybe more positively and more, I guess, proactively. But I just want to, obviously the title of your book is Ending the Social Care Crisis, so that word is bandied about a lot. A lot of people were quite critical of the use of that term, crisis.
Yeah.
For you, what are the most urgent issues in social care in England?
I think if you asked many people that question, they would refer to things like the workforce, the fact that there's over 160,000 vacancies, the lack of money, austerity, the impact that's had, the impact of COVID, people stuck in hospital, people not getting the care that they need, younger disabled people not getting choice and control, that sort of thing. And those are all valid issues, but I think they are symptoms. And it seems to me that the underlying cause of those symptoms is the failure to bring social care up to date to the in response to the great sweep of change we've seen in this country over the last 75 years. I mean, interestingly, I think a lot of the problems in the NHS are caused by a failure to address the new realities of life as it is 75 years on from when it was founded in 1948. And I think the fundamental problem with social care is that we're still stuck in this 1948 mindset. The former minister once talked about social care's dirty little secret, which is that, in fact, it's not like the NHS, it's not universal. It's actually a very minimal safety net for the poorest people with the greatest needs. And that's become more accentuated in recent years. And that is the fundamental operating model for social care, that unless you're relatively poor, And unless you have very high needs, you're on your own, actually. There've been some attempts to kind of shift that over the years, the creation of social services departments in the 70s, and then we had the community care reforms. And the Care Act has tried to make it a bit more universal, but I think has tried it because of lack of investment. So the basic trajectory of social care, which is a minimal safety net for a relatively small number of people, hasn't really changed very much. We still have means testing, for example, in a way that would be unthinkable if we applied that to the NHS. So we, and because we're all better off, or many of us are better off, that has become a live issue, the issue of people having to sell their homes to pay for care. It wasn't an issue in 1948. Most people didn't own homes. Most people didn't live long enough to need formal care. And if they did, they'd either get it from their families or from the NHS in a long stay ward or whatever. So we've had all these changes over 75 years, and we're still operating in the tramlines for social care of a 1948 settlement. And that is the fundamental underlying cause of why we have got so many symptoms and pressures bubbling up.
Mm, thank you very much. So there's so much in this book that is very informative and nuanced, but your point there about some of the differences between the social care and the NHS, you mentioned about, you know, social care being means tested, and you kind of pointed that the idea of that being the case of the NHS is sort of unfathomable. And one point quite early in the book, you state that there's a different political or moral calculus to entitlements for social care compared with healthcare. Can you say a little bit about that? Why it's one of the things about social care that interests me a lot, but I'm interested to think a bit more about why that might be the case and why you think that might be the case.
Sure. So I think it's back to this issue of universality in part, that back in 1948, when it was all set up and the NHS was created to this great fanfare, and that wonderful leaflet that everybody had pushed through their letterbox explaining what this new service was, that everybody could use it. It would be free at the point of use. It would be paid for through taxes. And because at that point, virtually everybody would need healthcare at some point in their lives, this created a huge relief that, you know, there was no longer the fear of paying the doctor or, you know, getting the healthcare you need. So, you know, that began the country's long love affair with the NHS, which continues to this day, or despite the current travails. And the point is that the NHS gives people that huge peace of mind, knowing that whatever happens to them health-wise, they haven't got to worry about the bill. Now, the same thinking, I think, wasn't applied to social care then. Nobody talked about social care in 1948. The opening words of the equivalent legislation for social care, which was the National Assistance Act, basically said an act to eliminate the poor law. That was good as it got. And then, of course, life expectancy was much lower. We didn't see the levels of chronic illness and disease that we have now. So the incidence of social care need in the general population was very low. People just didn't see it as an issue, and it wasn't, for reasons I've previously explained. And that has persisted, even though all these years later, that demographic position has fundamentally changed. Most of us now will have some kind of care need at some point in our lives. We don't know when, we don't know for how long. It might be end of life, it might be much earlier in our lives because of a disability, a road accident, or injuries acquired in military service. It could be any reason or you know, just personal misfortune. So most of us will have a care need. One in seven of us will need care that costs at least £100,000. So this is a huge change since 1948. So I think, and we'll probably come on to this later, that I think the public as a whole generally don't appreciate the significance of it, and the fact that social care is now as universal a need as is healthcare. That wasn't the case in 48, but we're still operating with this kind of twin track, rather schizoid attitude that the NHS must be free at the point of use, whereas social care, let's have a debate about how much people have got to pay and what carers have got to do. And you know, politicians can openly state that they think that the family should be the primary, should have primary responsibility for care, and all sorts of statements, which if they were applied to the NHS would be greeted with outrage. Could you imagine anybody having to sell their house to pay for their cancer treatment? You know, I mean, no politician would get away with that. So I think we do need to expose this kind of almost hypocrisy, actually, in our attitude, because need is need, whether it's healthcare need or it's for care and support.
Yeah, and I think that final point you make there about how often debate about funding and reform of social care seems to boil down to property and wealth and things like that. Yeah. I think that's a very important point. How can we get beyond that? How do you think we can get beyond that discussion?
So I think the traditional approach to the social care reform has essentially consisted of various kind of reformers and lobbyists and campaigners essentially shouting at the government to do something about social care, to demand that the government do something, which the government of the day thinks will be poorly understood by the public, will be politically unpopular, will cost them votes. And actually, they've got some cause to believe in that. Just look at what happened with so-called death tax row in the 2010 election. And then Theresa May had the same issue with her dementia tax debacle in the 2017 election. So it's very easy, particularly at election time, for politicians to kind of weaponize social care and use their opponents' commitments as a kind of stick to beat them with. So I think one of the fundamental changes we've got to adopt is actually taking the arguments of the public. And I've been very influenced by the work of an American political scientist, Joseph Overton, who said that instead of campaigners, policymakers, instead of trying to persuade politicians to do unpopular things, we've got to persuade the public to support popular policies. You've got to get the policy in that Overton window where change is supportable. So that's what I think we've got to do. We've got to raise public awareness that social care is a universal need. It's important for our peace of mind. It's important that carers can go out to work, that disabled people can get jobs with the right social care support. And we don't have to worry about it in the same way that we don't have to worry about healthcare costs. So that means turning the policy making process on its head and starting with the public.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Richard. I was interested in your point in your opening answer about the idea of having a book and having a lot of these important issues and ideas in one place. And I think that the book acts as a great resource for that to that end. So in chapter two of the book, you discuss the history of social care, adult social care in England, and you've obviously touched on quite a lot of some of these policy changes already, and you've also kind of linked that in with some of the kind of wider societal demographic changes. I just wanted to ask if there's anything you think that we can learn from the sort of history, the historical trajectory that would help improve things today.
I think the most significant learning point is not to overestimate the impact of the policy process. So, you know, in the last, I don't know, 25 years, we've seen a procession of white papers, green papers, consultation documents full of great ambitions and laudable intent. But in practice, haven't really made that much difference to the lives of people with social care needs. I mean, there have been some improvements and some breakthroughs, but generally speaking, they have failed to deliver reform on the scale that we need to to meet all those challenges that have developed over the last 75 years. The second thing I think we can learn is the importance of unintended consequences of things that happen that nobody planned or made explicit decisions. And there are two things that I pick out in the book. One is about how we ended up with this huge private market whereby over 90% of social care services are provided by private and independent sector organizations. Nobody ever said, let's have this big private market. It came about way back in the 1980s, some relatively obscure decision of local social security offices who decided, faced with pressure from local voluntary organizations and charities running residential services, that social security should pay a board and lodging allowance for their residents because they were under the cosh financially. And one or two offices agreed. Then it became a national policy, and that was the blue light really for all sorts of people piling in and setting up care homes because they could get bulk of the cost paid for through social security without any assessment of need. And that marked the beginning of a rapid explosion in the number of private care home places, and the emergence of this vast state-funded but privately run industry. And that's why we have got the so-called market in social care that we have today. Governments tried to regulate that. They brought in the community care reforms. They capped social security budget, transferred it to councils and expected them to assess people's needs for the first time and ration the care, which they did very effectively. But of course, the money transferred wasn't enough, and wasn't enough to keep up with demographic demand and costs. And that helps to explain why so many councils have been struggling and why providers complain that councils aren't paying them enough. So that's a little bit of history, which most people don't, well, a lot of people I think don't fully appreciate, that it wasn't an explicit policy choice to do it that way. The other developments, I think, which has enormously shaped the way social care operates today, is changes in the NHS. And what we've seen, particularly over the last 30 years or so, is a massive offloading of both costs and activity from the NHS onto social care. A lot of the debate currently is about the pressures that social care creates for the NHS, but actually it's two-way traffic. So the NHS has closed a lot of its long-stay provision. I mean, a lot of these developments are positive in the sense that nobody would oppose them. So they've closed a lot of their long-stay provision. They've transferred some of their provision for mental health and learning disability to the private sector. They've reduced the number of acute hospital beds, which is now kind of coming back to haunt them. And they've reduced length of stay in hospitals, and they do more treatment on a day case basis. But the effect of that little group of changes is to shift the recuperative and the kind of the convalescent part of a person's hospital journey onto the shoulders of families and the social care system. So people are discharged from hospital much sooner. That's usually a good thing. Nobody needs to be in hospital unless they are acutely unwell. But again, that wasn't planned, and nobody said, well, we're going to do this, but this is going to have an impact on social care and some community health services as well, like district nurses, for example. Nobody said, let's kind of plan that out and let's shift some resource across. It just happened without any planning, any sort of estimates of the resource requirements. So that means that the volume of work that a modern social care system has to do is much greater. But also, I think it means that the acuity and the complexity of people's needs is much greater. And you talk to anybody that's worked in home care services over the last few years, and they will say now that they're dealing with needs that people have in their own homes that previously district nurses would have done. People in care homes would say that a lot of their residents now, years ago, would have been in a nursing home. and people in nursing homes would say a lot of their residents would have been in a hospice or in a hospital bed. So there has been this big shift in acuity of need over a number of years. And that means that because of the resource constraints, fewer people are getting more care. They're getting more intensive packages of care and support. And it's also got big implications for the nature of the workforce you need to deliver that care and the kind of the skill levels, which is why it is absolutely absurd to suggest, as some do, that social care is not a skilled occupation. That patently is not the case anymore, if it ever was. So those are the two of the biggest kind of factors which I think of that we can learn from history about unintended consequences, and don't overestimate what the latest green paper, white paper is. It's not going to change the world, probably.
Thank you very much. And in terms of thinking about another context, though, moving from the historical context to the geographic or the political context. In chapter five, you look abroad. So can you briefly say what we could learn from other countries? Maybe give an example.
Yes, I mean I spent a lot of time actually looking at other countries, and there's different approaches, and I think the one obvious learning point is that there is no magic bullet here that we you could say, well, if we do what Australia did or what Sweden has done, everything will be okay. And so there's no one set of solutions that can easily be replicated in another country, because it's all very context specific. Every country's got its own unique context and culture, which shapes the way it does things. And I think the historians call it path dependency. So that when Germany, for example, was reforming its approach to social care, it adopted a long-term care insurance. It went down a social insurance route. And that's because there is a long tradition in Germany, particularly through healthcare, of social insurance. It began with Bismarck in the 19th century with unemployment insurance. So Germany went down that road. Scandinavians have opted more for general taxation as a funding method. So every country is different in that sense. But I think on a positive note, I mean, we can take hope from the fact that many countries have introduced long-term reforms. You know, a whole range of countries across the world have done this. I don't think anybody has really cracked the problem. It's a bit like painting the fourth bridge. So what most countries tend to find is they introduce changes to make care better. And whenever you do that, another learning point, the costs go up because more people come forward and needs are revealed. So there's then a debate about, well, how do we make this sustainable? And then they adjust as they go along. So even countries with social insurance schemes find that they have to look at kind of subsidizing that a bit with money from general taxation. Countries like Sweden or Netherlands, Scandinavian countries generally, rely on some personal payments to top up relatively high levels of state expenditure. So I think the lesson is that you can do this. It is possible to introduce change, but you then have to kind of adjust it as you go along, and not expect it to kind of improve things all at once. And that's the third point, actually. It takes time. And if you look at Japan and Germany, which are two of the examples that are often quoted, I mean, it took over a decade to kind of launch the process, get people on board, raise awareness of the issues. And it was that methodical, planned approach, preparing ground, instead of doing what we've tended to do over the years, which is plunge straight into let's have a levy on people's estates to pay for social care. Never mind starting with engaging with the public about what is social care, why is this important, how much does it cost? These are some of the ways we could pay for it. What do you think? We go straight in with, you know, let's have this new tax to pay for social care, which immediately frightens the horses and toxifies the whole issue. So I think there's a lot we can learn from other countries about the process. I've been particularly impressed in United States with the Caring Across Generations movement, which is a very broad alliance of campaigning groups trying to get improved care and support for carers of all ages, and both for children and for adults and for younger disabled people, who I think have had some success in creating public support for change. That what I talked about earlier, that public realization that good care is something we need, you know, to live our lives, to live a good life. So there's lots of movements like that I think we can learn from. In Australia, they have Every Australian Counts, written some really, really good work, and of breaking out of the shackles of the traditional policymaking process whereby a government issues a green paper and there's statutory consultation period and you have to write in. This is much more fresh, it's much more engaging.
Thanks very much, Richard. That's really interesting to have these insights from different places. So, as you said in your opening answer, you know, one of the things you're trying to think about is that big question, you know, what can we do? And so you save your most deepest, your most developed ideas for reform to the final chapter of your book, but you make suggestions and recommendations throughout the book. Maybe for the for potential readers, can you maybe briefly summarise some of your kind of key proposals for reforms, or some of the key things that you think would make a difference?
So first of all, I think it's important to distinguish between process and outcomes. I think a lot of the debate in England has been quite technical. It's been about policy options, funding methods, and so on. And it's been quite narrow. And we haven't really thought very much about the process of change. You can have all these wonderful ideas, but how do you actually get them implemented? So I think there's three, I call it a different road to reform, and there's three things that have got to be fundamentally different. So the first is a new focus on building public support for better social care. And I talked about that earlier, so I won't repeat it, but it's just kind of making people aware that social care is really, really important for us to have a good life, to enjoy the peace of mind that we have with healthcare through the NHS. So I think we need a whole load of public conversations, probably locally, then built up into a national debate and dialogue, and to get social care into that Overton window of realistic change. The second thing we think we've got to do different, and it's part of that process of building public support, is to really get into some of the tools and techniques of deliberative democracy and co-production, of involving people with lived experience of social care much more, of engaging with local groups and citizens about this. There've been some recent examples of focus groups, of citizen assemblies and so on, participatory budgeting, to really get alongside people and work up some ideas and get people on board with the issues that need to be tackled. Now, the third thing I think we've got to do is to shift from short-term fixes, which I think has been a real problem for social care, particularly in the last 7 to 10 years, that the government has actually put some more money in, but it's done it in the least effective or efficient way, which is short-term, last-minute, hand-to-mouth funding that's all going to be spent within months. And, you know, and actually it almost perpetuates the broken system. It props it up. Instead of building a bridge to a better system, those kind of short-term bunks of money just prop up a failing system. And everybody that works in social care knows that the problems are not going to be fixed overnight. They're going to need a long-term approach. So a shift from short-term fixes to long-term planning. So those are the three processings which I think need to be different. In terms of policy ideas, I mean, I could talk for England on this in terms of the outcomes that we want, but it seems to me there are really three big things we should be looking to achieve. The first is a new social contract for care, a new kind of deal that really clarifies and sets out what people can reasonably expect from the state in terms of not only care delivery, but who pays for it as well. But also people's sense of obligation and responsibilities that we have towards each other. And I've been very influenced by Minouche Shafiq's book on a new social contract, What We Owe Each Other. Because as I said earlier, we're still operating in tram lines of a 1948 social contract, when the expectation was actually that in return for family allowances, for free education, universal healthcare, and full employment, that basically women would stay at home and look after the kids and relatives needing care. It was never written down, but that was basically the deal. And of course, that's gone now. Totally unsustainable and inequitable. But we don't have anything to replace it. So I think we do need to a new social contract for care that also would make social care much more intelligible and easier to understand and navigate. The second big change I think we need to look towards is really turning upside down the very traditional models of care that we have at the moment, which is very much based on professional discretion and eligibility and what's around in your area. And I think we need to shift the balance fundamentally towards giving people the opportunity to direct their own support, not just through relatively crude mechanisms like personal budgets, but actually giving them rights that can be enforced when they can't get their direct payment or whatever, and really make it possible for individuals to shape their own care and support and try and recapture some of the promise of the direct payments movements over 30 years ago. And the third outcome, I think, and this is the final one and it's crucial, and that is a new funding settlement and a new, probably part of the new social contract about, you know, what is reasonable to expect from private contributions as opposed to the public purse. And that might be anything from free, completely free personal care towards, you know, modest contributions for accommodation costs or whatever. That's where we need to have the big debate, I think. But as I emphasized earlier, that needs to come at the end when we're clear about what is the social care that we need and what is it we're trying to fund in the first place. But we can't fudge that. And in the book, I talk about all sorts of ways that we can raise the money. These are essentially political choices. I personally feel that where social care suffers at the moment is that our tax system in England is heavily skewed towards taxes on work rather than taxes on wealth. And actually, we have vast sums of property wealth in particular and pension wealth. Much of it is unearned. And we ought to be thinking much more imaginatively about how we broaden the base of that. But that perhaps gets us into a different kind of discussion. But the point is that social care is affordable. You know, it's about our relative priorities. And I think if we were stuck, we went back to 1948, knowing then what we know now, we wouldn't end up with a 170 billion NHS budget and a 22 billion social care budget. It would probably be much more equally balanced.
Thank you very much. And I think that that gives a great kind of introduction to those points that you, obviously in the book, you develop those a lot more. And yeah, I'd certainly recommend people to go and engage with those more in the book. So just finally, I just wanted to ask you about the life of the book. What are your, you know, you talked at the start a little bit about some of your motivations, the idea of having your ideas in one place, the experience, your personal experience with your father, even the opportunity, I guess, a little bit that you had through lockdown and that time. But what are your hopes for the book?
Yes, I mean, interesting. I decided to write from the word go that I wasn't going to write a traditional textbook, that I wanted this to be of interest and relevance to a wide range of people. And I'm kind of reassured by comments from friends and relatives that actually they thought it was much more readable than they thought it was going to be. So I'll take praise whenever it comes from, really. So it was, yeah, it was aimed to be accessible. So, you know, I hope that it will be read by a wide range of people. I suspect at the moment that I'm preaching to the converted, to be honest, in terms of the current readership. You know, I'm not sure how you break out of that. But, you know, I just wanted to kind of, you know, just help stimulate the debate out there, really. And I think one of the problems with the social care sector, if I can use that term, is that it tends to be the same people having the same conversations with each other. And I do feel that we've got to get the great strengths of social care and the enormous potential it has to, as a force of good in society. We need to get that out there in the wider public so that, you know, people can realise just how important this is and what a great thing it is, and that it's something that is worthy of investing in, whether that's through our taxes or whatever other resources there are.
That's it. Thanks very much for that, Richard. And can I just ask you, can you just share with listeners how they can get a hold of the book?
Oh, gosh. So, I mean, I think you can get it through Amazon, obviously, and other online sellers. You can order it directly from the Policy Press at the University of Bristol.
Thank you. For more episodes in the Care Matters series, and to learn more about the Centre for Care, please follow the link in the episode description for our website and social media channels. All that remains for me to do is to thank our guest, Richard Humphreys. So thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Thank you.